The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for May 20th, 2017. It's been an interesting and eventful week in cycling. Unfortunately, more crashes, another fatality in Boston, and a pro rider who went down hard. Then there is the cyclist who was shot in the back in New Orleans last Saturday. Velo News reported that a 49-year-old Christopher Weiss was riding with a group of 10 other riders last Saturday morning when he was shot in the back. Christopher was taken to University Hospital, where doctors said he was not at risk of a serious injury. But I'm wondering, what is a serious injury if a gunshot wound isn't? NOLA.com reported Weiss, an oil industry consultant, said he was taken to University Hospital, where he received news the bullet hadn't hit any vital organs. It had come to rest in soft tissue not far from his spine, he said. There may be some nerve damage with some, quote, leg mobility issues, end quote. The doctors hope the effects are temporary. At this stage, he said, the doctors don't intend to remove the bullet. In addition to the physical damage, Weiss said he's suffering a sense of dread. They're snipering bicyclists, he said. You're an abstract object. Weiss, who has a young son, said his wife has now forbidden him from more bicycling. The incident wasn't Weiss's first run-in with criminal activity while cycling. He said he once had someone attempt to mug him while he was riding, bloodying his ear. In my opinion, this is one of those incidents that can strike terror into the hearts of all of us. It gives new meaning to watching each other's back. So on a more pleasant note, how would you like to win an adventure travel every year for life? Yeah, me too. Well, here's the skinny on it if you're interested. From Toronto, Canada, May 15th, 2017, pioneering tour operator Exodus Travels is making history with the launch of a travel contest that is truly the first of its kind. Hashtag Life of Exodus contest kicked off May 15th, offering travelers across the U.S. and Canada the chance to fulfill their dreams of wanderlust and to win one trip a year for the rest of their lives. The Win a Trip for Life contest is simple to enter. Intrepid travelers explore the contest site, choose their top three dream trips from Exodus Travel's massive portfolio, and sit back to see if they will be packing their bags to explore the world every year for life. Quote, not only is this the chance to win the adventure of a lifetime, but it's an adventure that will last a lifetime, says Robin Brooks, marketing and PR manager for Exodus Travels. Man, this sounds like such a cool thing. I would love to do that. If you are interested in entering the contest, you can go to winatripforlife.com. So, in fact, we actually do have a really good show for you tonight. My first guests are Jim and Maria Parker, the husband and wife team who own and operate Cruise Bike. Their most recent Kickstarter campaign was funded quickly to bring a new model, the T50, to market. The bike is meant to bring down the cost of the recumbent-style bike and make it affordable to a broader market. Our conversation, though, goes to some of the frustrations that Jim and Maria have been facing for years in getting recumbent-style machines into sanctioned triathlons. Jim and Maria feel they've been getting the runaround from USAT as to why recumbents are not permitted in the race. So in an effort to get a balanced view, I actually called USAT's offices in Colorado Springs and was put through to their performance team. Karen McConey came back to me with the following statement. There are two primary reasons for not permitting recumbents in triathlon events. The first one is a safety issue. Because recumbent bikes are lower to the ground, just because of their construction, they're sort of long and lean. They don't have the same amount of lateral mobility that a standard bike has. It limits ability of moving side to side and keeping away from others, so it's really just a crashing risk. Simply a safety issue. The other reason is efficiency of energy when you are riding a recumbent bike compared to a regular bike. It's really a performance differential. Recumbents are the most efficient form of transport. It's really not the same efficiency. It's really not a level playing field to put a recumbent bike in a race with other regular bikes. You're going to hear Jim and Maria's side in a moment. Then after our break, we're off to Long Island to speak with Jamie Swan. Jamie is somewhat of a legend in the frame building world. He started out as a wheel builder and a bike shop owner. He's an engineer who supports the staff at the Webb Institute, a small private school in New York that graduates only one discipline, marine architect. But wait, there's a whole lot more. Jamie is a frame builder's frame builder. He has produced less than two dozen frames, each of which is as close to perfection as one might think a frame can be. Jamie's into the detail, precision, and beauty. We talk about all kinds of things, from his choice of tubing, which is steel, and the way he fools the eye to accomplish fit. We also talk about his 200-year-old house. It's a great conversation. So let's head on down to North Carolina and speak with Jim and Maria Parker from Cruise Bike. Hi, Maria and Jim. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me. It's nice to be able to talk with you again, Maria.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here, Dan.
Oh, good. Where are you guys? You're in the South somewhere, right?
North Carolina.
Yeah, that's south of me, so I guess it's somewhere. So, you know, the last time you and I spoke, Maria, we were just wrapping up Recumbent CycleCon in 2015, and here we are a year and a half later. How have you been? How is business?
Business is terrific. We're growing so fast and doing so many things and bringing new products to market. And as always, our community of customers is just really out there enjoying one another and doing a lot of talking. We call it the tribes. It's been a really, really exciting time for us the last year and a half.
Well, we have a tribe here, too, called the Cleveland Indians, and we're hoping that they bring home a World Series this year. Hi, Jim. I don't know much about you. Tell us a little bit about your background and your involvement with Cruise Bikes.
Well, I'm one of the founders of Cruise Bike about 11 years ago. I am a medical doctor. I'm a radiologist and still full-time practice, and very interested in the health and safety aspects of cycling and cruise biking, and also lately really gotten into the racing aspects of it.
Is cruise biking a term now?
Yeah, you know, it has been for a while, yeah. People go cruise biking, yeah.
On a cruise bike?
On a cruise bike.
We're going to talk about the racing part of it in a little bit, but I want to know about your new bike. You have a Kickstarter campaign. It's doing very well. The new bike is called a T50, yes?
Yeah, Marie, do you want to handle that?
Sure. The T50, actually, the idea of it came a long time ago when we were making bicycles that people loved but that a lot of people couldn't afford. And for years, I've been wanting to make a more affordable bike. And to do that, we have to make large numbers. So our T50 is a very simple frame and can be made fairly inexpensively because of its simplicity. It's got everything that makes a cruise bike a cruise bike. It's a recumbent front-wheel drive bike. But the frame is very clean and simple, and we hope that it's going to be affordable. The point of the Kickstarter campaign is to see if there's much interest out there. And as you've seen, we're fully funded, more than fully funded, and so we assume that this is indeed what people want.
Evidently, it is. Your campaign has not been out there that long. How much longer does it have to run?
I think we have 21 more days, 21 or 22 more days.
And what did you do, start with 30 days total?
Yeah, I think 35 is what we started with.
Wow.
They say that if this is your first campaign, you should start with 30 or 35. So we went with 35.
This is going to be a weird question. How did you choose Kickstarter as opposed to another crowdfunding organization?
Well, you know, that's a great question that I can't really answer. Lucia, who is our marketing guru, is the one who came up with the idea of crowdfunding the T50. And so I think she picked Kickstarter. Jimmy,
well, it's the only one. It's the only crowdfunding thing I've ever participated in. I've actually, for years, I've been a backer of other entrepreneurs' projects, and I always use Kickstarter for that. So that was the only one I had jumped in on before in you know, non-bicycle-related areas.
Interesting, because I was just looking at crowdfunding platforms for another project, and Kickstarter, I guess, you need to have some sort of a product that you're trying to fund, as opposed to, say, you know, somebody needs medical assistance. You have to go to some other, you know, personal
thing. There are crowdfunding platforms that allow you to give, you know, outside of a charity, or we've donated and given to those as well. And I suppose there's other crowdfunding platforms that, you know, where you can put your product, but I'm not aware of them.
Yeah.
Like Jim, Kickstarter is the one I think about when I think about buying something new.
One of the things that your page says about the T50 is that health-related issues can be resolved by riding this bike as opposed to something else. What are some of those health-related issues that you want this bike to address?
Well, any recumbent will take the pressure off of the perineum, and that's the soft, fleshy part of our pelvis, whether you're male or female. There are a lot of very important little nerves and arteries in that area of our body that if you're sitting with your body weight directly over that on a standard bicycle saddle, you can cause either temporary or even permanent damage to those tissues. And that's been shown with and published in peer-reviewed medical journals to significantly increase the risk of erectile dysfunction in men who ride as little as 3 hours a week. And it can also cause genital numbness in women. That's one issue, so that's a big one for a lot of people. Then also just the standard bike requires your weight, your body weight to be distributed on your feet, your hands, and the saddle. You got those 5 points to carry all of your body weight, whereas on a recumbent, the weight is distributed over your entire back and sacrum. And so that's just like if you're reclining in a easy chair. That is what basically what we ride on. So it's a much larger area to distribute the weight, so we don't have the pressure point issues of the wrists and pain in the shoulders. You don't have to arch your neck. So there's just a lot fewer musculoskeletal issues. Those are issues I categorize in the category of health. And then if you want to, we can talk about safety, which is it's kind of a related issue, but that's also something that's important.
Yeah, sure. I definitely want to talk about safety. Safety is hugely important.
Yeah, so moving from the chronic health issues, that's just riding a bike when you don't wreck or don't meet a car, unfortunately, in a car accident. But just riding, that's the health issues. But as we all know, bicycling carries other dangers with a collision with a dog, the grade of a sewer, a piece of metal that somebody left in the road. So the standard bike puts the rider center of gravity very high. If you think about the front axle, the front wheel axle, that is a fulcrum. That's a rotation point. So when a bike hits something and the center of gravity is high, it will rotate around the front axle. And what that does on a standard bike is it dumps you right on your head, basically. So you land on your head or shoulder and you break your clavicle. Bicycling is one of the leading causes of head injuries. And it's because the standard bike puts your head in a far forward position, so you're leading with your head, and it's way up in the air, so it hits the ground very suddenly and quickly and devastating results. Recumbents have the body position is lower, and you're actually leading through the air with your feet. So it's very hard to do a frontal endover on a recumbent. Well, it's very easy to do it on a standard bike. So you almost never see recumbents endover. If they get in a wreck, they usually will slide out, and you'll get road rash, some abrasions, but you won't get the head injuries nearly as often. So that's the big safety issue. The other big issue is we have a better view of the road because of our head position is always up. So we're always looking out. Whereas if especially people who ride road bikes and they're trying to go fast, they get into this aero tuck position, which typically puts the eyes facing the ground, basically the road right in front of the bike, and they have to look up or crane their head up. And typically after a while, they'll get fatigued and they'll drop their head down. It's also more aero if you drop your head down. And then they take their eyes off the road. And if you watch closely coverage of road races, you will see a lot of these guys are racing as hard as they can, and they're looking at the ground in front of them or the bike in front of them. They're not looking out there. And if a car is coming across the lane or there's a dog running out, they don't see it as soon as we see it. So that's another big safety issue.
That is all true. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jim and Maria Parker. They are the proprietors of Cruise Bike. There is a new bike called the T50. It's up on Kickstarter if you want to take a look at it. It is funded, but you can still get one. A lot of them are sold out. A lot of your Kickstarter offers are already gone.
Yeah, we sold a couple of the colors quickly. In fact, we released new colors so that people could still get a color. But the original colors are retired in honor of our early backers.
That's nice.
It is nice. Yeah, well, we're thrilled to have such enthusiastic early backers.
So I want to switch gears, pun intended. Your bikes have won a lot of awards and events, and yet there is resistance to allowing the recumbent style bike in certain races. Maria, I know you've done a lot of work to have that changed. What's going on right now with USAT, the triathlon governing body?
Nothing. They've pretty much stonewalled us. We have written letters and called, and we've written letters to every member of the USAT board. If you're out there listening, please give us a call. We had one board member kind of respond favorably before he got shut down by the rest of the board. We're not really sure what the reason is. Jim can talk more about it. It's kind of a circular argument.
What is the resistance? What is the problem? Because they could certainly give it a new category.
That's all we're asking, really. But their arguments shift. You know, I've had discussions with their head officials, and they'll say, well, you know, recumbents, they can't race. They're too slow. And I say, well, actually, they're actually quite fast. Well, they can't race because they're too fast. That's not fair. They're too fast. And I say, well, you know, make a different category. Well, no, it's not really that. It's not that they're too fast. It's you know what it is? It's our insurance. Yeah, our insurance company just won't do it. Sorry. It's just a shifting argument.
So what do you think the real issue is?
I think it's prejudice. It's bias against recumbents. There's a term, I don't think we coined it, but we use it. It's called bikeism. And it's, you know it when you see it. But if you ride out there, I've had friends on recumbents who have been spit on by standard bike riders. And most standard bike riders they're okay with it. They're not afflicted with bikeism. But unfortunately, there's a significant percentage that are, including a good friend of ours who just says our bike, that's not a real bike. A real bike has to be like my bike. And your bike isn't a real bike. And, you know, I'm talking about Tom, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Such an interesting attitude, you know.
It's just a resistance to change, Diane. I think change is hard, and the bigger the organization, the harder it is to make the change. Certainly, the USAT has adopted aero bars, which were not legal initially, and many other things. But we've been at them for, what, Jim, 10 years?
Yeah, a long time. And it's just, you know, what this generation who's leading the USAT, they're going to see, and their statistics are public, there's a massive drop in participation in triathlons in people's 40s and 50s and 60s. And it's because of these, you know, they get wise to the dangers of cycling and the pain of cycling, and people just quit triathloning. So I try to convince them, look, if you allow other bikes in there, people can keep doing triathlons and riding long distances much further into their lives, and they won't have to give it up in their 30s and 40s. But, you know, until people start to understand that, they're just not listening.
So I have an idea for you guys. Start an event that is recumbent-centric.
I would love to do that. It's on my list of things to do, but, you know, I only have so many hours in the day.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, it's a great idea, and it's I think it's time has come.
Well, But here's the thing. Now, let me just point out something. So the last dialogue I had with the USAT, that was their final conclusion. They said, okay, so here's the deal. This was from their president, said, emailed me and said, okay, so here's what we want you to do. You guys start a new triathlon. You run your own triathlons. When we see high participation recumbents, then we will reconsider it. But even if it's wildly successful, we're not saying that we would let recumbents, but we want you to go out there and do it. But if you look at their material, they are anti any other triathlon organization. So they will try to stomp out any other triathlon organization that's trying to compete with them. Yet they're telling us to go out there and start our own company. But even if we do, they're not going to listen to what our results are. So they're talking out both sides of their mouths.
Yeah, I can believe that that's true.
Yeah, you can hear our frustration.
I can.
It's not just the USAT, you know, it's road cycling in general.
It's USA Cycling, and it's the UCI. So it's at the international level, it's at the U.S. level, and it's at the triathlon level.
We should say that there is an organization that allows our bikes and encourages them.
And that is?
That's the Ultra Marathon Cycling Association. They have a new name, World Ultra Cycling Association, the UMCA or the WUCA.
Well, unfortunately, it's that critical mass, that tipping point of when the numbers get to where they can't deny it. I don't know what the numbers are for alternative bikes, if you want to call it that. But, you know, your market is obviously there. You're selling a lot of bikes. Recumbent CycleCon is a very successful show. When I was there the last 2 years, people came from all over to ride these bikes. I mean, literally all 50 states and out of the country.
Well, yeah, people don't want to give up cycling. Or, Diane, I meet a lot of people who remember the joy of cycling. And when they get on a bike, they go to their bike shop or they go to Walmart and they buy a bike. And after about 3 miles, they're thinking to themselves, no, this isn't fun like it was when I was 7 or 8 years old. And the beauty of all recumbents, and ours, I think, in particular, is that it brings the joy of cycling back. If your listeners will close their eyes and remember how they felt when they were, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old and they got on their bikes and they were able to, you know, explore their neighborhood and go further than they've ever gone, you know, and just the joy of moving through the wind that brought them, that's what they want. I mean, that's what everybody wants. And frankly, their traditional bicycle, often for many, many people, it just doesn't happen. It's just too uncomfortable. They're managing their discomfort. So
let me give you some hope from experience. I can remember in my shop in the 1980s, the first electric bikes were being talked about. Here we are 30 years later, and electric bikes are finally becoming more mainstream. Now, I'm not assuming you're going to wait 30 years.
Yeah, was that supposed to be encouraging?
Well, because things are happening so much faster because of social media, because of the way, you know, news travels. I'm not so sure you're going to have to wait as long as you think. And I know you're frustrated. I can hear it. I think that there might be a breakthrough not too far down the road.
Well, I hope so. But in the meantime, we're loving our bikes and enjoying them. They're great for touring and they're great for commuting. And, you know, as an athlete, I desperately want to participate in a triathlon, an officially sanctioned triathlon on my cruise bike. But, you know, if they don't want me, then I don't want them. And, you know, so it's not all about competing.
No, of course not.
You know, it's the chicken or the egg. You know, we feel like if they would allow our bikes, then it would open up cycling. You know, cycling, USA Cycling, and the World Cycling Organizations are all about, they say, they're all about openness and inclusivity. And so we're saying, yeah, if that's the case, allow us in your events. Because in the end, a lot of people who get fit want to participate. They want to measure themselves. And so they want to participate in these events. That's what happened to me. You know, I got fit and I thought, oh, I wonder how well I can do against others. But even if that doesn't happen, even as that isn't happening right now, we're still selling many bikes and bringing joy to many people. And, you know, our mission statement is to get more people on bikes. So, you know, we're getting people on bikes who won't get on a regular bike. So we feel like we're doing great.
Well, why don't you give our listeners the website and then the Kickstarter information for the T50?
Okay, so our website is cruisebike.com, and it's CRUZBIKE.com. If you go there, you can click right through on our main page to the Kickstarter site. And that's right now on Kickstarter. You can buy a cruise bike for cheaper than you're ever going to get it again. So I'm saying, if you thought about it, if you thought about getting into recumbents, if you wanted an inexpensive way to do it, now is the time. You got 21 more days.
That's really cool. Well, thanks so much for talking with me. It's great to catch up with you. It was nice meeting you, Jim, even though it's over the phone. And good luck. We'll see what happens going down the road.
Great.
Thanks, Diane.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Jim and Maria Parker from Cruise Bike join me from their home in North Carolina. Interesting conversation. We will see what happens with the triathlon and recumbent situation. I'm not sure which side makes more sense. It seems to me that perhaps triathlon could consider a recumbent category. We need to take a break. We'll be back to speak with Jamie Swan. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back, and we are, as I promised, off to Long Island to speak with Jamie Swan. Hi, Jamie. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me.
Well, it is my pleasure because I have been told for a while I need to talk with Jamie Swan, and I have been remiss, and I'm glad we're going to get this opportunity today.
Can't wait.
Okay. Well, here we go. So I want to talk a little bit about your history, but I want to begin in sort of reverse chronological order with what you're doing now and sort of back into what you did way back in the 70s. So you gave a lecture on building modern bicycle frames and using traditional methods and materials last month somewhere in New York. I think it was in the city, right?
Yes. The venue is called the General Society of Mechanics and Tradesmen for the City of New York. It's founded in 1785, and it's a fantastic venue. Fantastic organization, and I would encourage your listeners to Google that and check it out.
Well, give us an overview of the topic, and you know, if we could really do an in-depth conversation about that, would probably take all the afternoon, which is okay too.
Yeah, right. Well, the thing is, I wasn't sure what the audience would be there. I assumed that it would be a general audience and not, you know, a room full of bike riders. So it's an organization that looks at various different trades and crafts, and I was part of the artisan lecture series. So I just wanted to run through, for that audience, the methodology of making a bicycle out of steel, and specifically brazed construction as opposed to welded construction. So I explained to them the kind of steel that we use and a little bit about butted tubing, that we use lugs to hold tubes together, the difference between brazing and welding, the difference between sweat brazing and fillet brazing. And then I went off onto a jag about lug cutting, which I thought that audience would find it interesting, you know, the artistic side, the aesthetic side of steel frame building. And I talked quite a bit about the Randon O-ring bikes that I'm interested in now.
Yeah, me too. So was it a big audience? Was it a fairly good-sized audience?
The room seats 180, and I think there was about 75 there, so it wasn't a huge turnout for that place, but I was pleased.
Sure. Did you get questions?
A few, not a real lot, but everyone seemed, you know, I got a very enthusiastic response.
That's cool. That's really cool. And all of those topics would be of interest to me, you know, every last one of them. So one of the really intriguing aspects about you is about tool making, and that you actually are really into tools, make your own tools. You have a lot of tools. Of course, I don't know any engineer who doesn't have a lot of tools. But tell us a little bit about your own tools, what tools you've developed and for what purposes.
I assume you mean with regard to building bicycle frames.
Not necessarily. I'm interested in lots of topics.
Well, I think I'm probably better prepared to address the tools for bicycle frame building. Okay, so we'll talk about that.
Okay.
Well, let's talk about my frame building jig. I mean, most frame builders will buy a jig, but some guys make their own. It's like a point of pride with me to have fabricated my own as a machinist. And it has an interesting feature that maybe your listeners, if they're bike nerds, my jig, I'm able to adjust the alignment of the frame in the jig. I think if you buy a commercially made jig, let's say you could magically freeze that frame, put the tubes in the jig, and then magically freeze it in that position, then take it off and put it on an alignment table and check the alignment. We don't know, there's no way to really know for sure if it's holding the frame in excellent alignment. I was about to use the word perfect, but let's say near perfect alignment. So if it's not holding it in perfect alignment, you're basically at the mercy of how that frame fixture holds the tubes. My little innovation is that I can adjust the alignment of the frame. I think you've probably seen these frame jigs where they have a cone in the top of the head tube and a cone in the bottom of the head tube and then a cone in the top of the seat tube as a way of holding the tubes. I can move those cones side to side very accurately. And so if it's not holding, if the jig isn't holding the frame perfectly, I can fine-tune it. And the next question that you should ask me is, how do you know when it's straight?
Well, that is a question, but I want to ask one right before that, and that has to do with, so this is while you are actually brazing the frame, you will stop and make adjustments?
No.
Oh, okay.
It's ahead of time.
Okay.
I'll set the geometry. I'll set for a particular frame, I'll set the head tube angle, the seat tube angle, et cetera. And then I'll fine-tune those cones side to side so that I know that my head tube and seat tube are in the same plane and that the rear wheel, imagine the rear rim is in the same plane as the head tube and the seat tube and that nothing is twisted out of plane.
Right.
So the thing is that I've developed a tool. It's kind of like the same concept as a dishing gauge to check those. I'll put the head tube and the seat tube in the fixture, and then I'll check them from side to side. I'll check the right side against the left side, and if the right side is exactly the same as the left side, then I'm pretty confident that things are straight in the jig.
So if that's the way you do it, how do other builders do it? Oh, they're taking the frame out of the jig and putting it on the alignment table and taking it back. Well, how come something doesn't move in the meantime?
Well, the thing is that things can move like crazy when you're welding or brazing the frame together, and they do move like crazy. So that's kind of a separate issue. What frame builders will do, they're at the mercy of the fixture. They just have to trust that it's good. So the typical building sequence, I think what most builders will do is put the tubes in the fixture and then just put a tiny amount of braze material on the tips of the lugs. They call that tacking the frame.
Right.
Take it off the fixture, put it on the alignment table, and check to see if it's straight.
Got it.
And then if they're happy that it's straight, they go ahead and finish brazing it, not in the jig, but in just the bicycle repair stand.
Right. Right.
So my experience with my frames is that when they come off the table and I put them on my, when they come off the jig and I put them on my alignment table, they are straight. I don't have to manipulate them. But if a builder who's building frequently, they may see that a frame will be, when they put it on the table, it's out of alignment in a certain way, and then every single frame is out of alignment in the same way. They start to look sideways at their fixture. It may or may not be the fixture's fault. It may be their brazing sequence. But frequently, if you go into a frame builder shop, you'll see little pieces of shim stock here and there where they're trying to fine-tune their fixture to hold the frame so that when they take it off the frame, after they tack it and they put it on the table, it looks straight.
And it's an interesting thing that you're talking about this particular topic, because years ago we were a dealer for a specific frame, and it shall remain nameless today. But out of 24 frames we ordered in 1 year, and they were all custom frames, 19 of them had rear dropout alignment issues. And we kept bringing it to the builder's attention. They kept saying, oh, you know, it must be your wheels. It must be your... And it turned out it was their problem, and they did figure out that they needed to fix something.
Yeah.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jamie Swan, and we're going to talk about something called, ready, metrology. All right, what is metrology, and why are you a metrologist?
I should start off by saying I'm not a metrologist. That's just Peter Weigel being his typical generous self and calling me that in one of his Flickr images.
My husband called you that.
Well, I'm sure Peter paid him to say that.
Yeah, handsomely.
Well, good. I'm glad. Metrology is, and this is off the top of my head, is probably, if you Google it, it may sound, say something a little different, but it's the science of measuring things, and typically as applied to precision metalworking, where you're trying to measure things at very, very accurate measurements. So I'm not a metrologist, but I did take some courses in college in where we worked in the metrology lab, and you just you start off with micrometers, and where you're measuring things to 3 decimal points or 4 decimal points, and then you work your way up to using Johansson gauge blocks and Cadillac gauges and super micrometers, and you eventually you're measuring things to millionths of an inch. But it's just simple mechanical measurements, you know. I mean, if you use a ruler, you're a metrologist.
Yeah, of some degree or another, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the Webb Institute and what you teach there. It seems so interesting. It has nothing to do with bicycles.
Sadly, yes. My friends say that I work at Boat School. It's a college of naval architecture and marine engineering. It was founded in 1887 by this guy named William Webb, who put up the money. It's a tiny school. The total enrollment has never exceeded 100. I think it's probably the high water mark is something like 92 students in the whole school. They only offer one degree, and that is a Bachelor of Science with a dual specialty in naval architecture and marine engineering. It's a beautiful campus. It's huge mansions perched up on a hill above the Long Island Sound, where, you know, direct waterfront. And I'm lucky enough to work there 3 days a week. I answer to the faculty. I'm a laboratory technician / machinist. So I'm not a professor. I support the faculty, but I do have some teaching duties. So I teach machine shop, various different aspects of machine shop and welding and things like that.
So these students go on to do things like building ships?
Designing ships. They become engineers and naval architects. They work in the maritime industry mostly, and most of it is in the heavy shipping side of things, you know, container ship, tankers, ferries and tugboats, barges, stuff like that. The offshore industry is another place where our graduates go. I should say that this is a very, very difficult school to get admitted to. The kids are really capable of getting probably a full tuition scholarship to any elite engineering college in the world, and we only admit about 28 students per year.
Wow. Sounds like a really interesting place to be, though.
Yeah. And did I mention that it's free if you get in?
No, you did not mention that. That's even more interesting.
It's full scholarship. Yeah, it's a fantastic place. The people are wonderful. My coworkers are just fantastic. I pinch myself every time I drive up that driveway because it's just a dream job.
That's cool. Liking something that much, loving it that much, that unto itself is cool, doing what you love.
My only regret is that it's not bike school.
Well, you know, you could start a bike school.
You know, it's a kind of a dream of mine, but I don't know if it'll ever happen.
Don't tempt us here.
Okay.
Okay. Let's move on before we come up with a whole new topic. I want to talk about your frames. So, you know, when we look at things like NABS and Bespoked and some of these shows, people are looking at frame builders and saying, oh, he's built 500 frames. He's built 1,000 frames. He's built whatever. Jamie Swan has not built that many frames, and yet people say you are the master and that your methods are meticulous. So I want to know if you almost approached this at the beginning of our conversation. I want to talk a little bit about perfection and what makes your frames so beautiful. If you look online at jamieswan.net, you get to see some of these frames.
I'm not sure what the question is. Sorry.
About perfection. What you aim for perfection? There really is no such thing, but how do you get as close as you get? What is it that makes people say the things they say about your frames?
I don't know. I'm kind of sheepish on the whole matter of how few bikes I've built in proportion to the amount of attention I get. I don't think that I'm getting anywhere near perfection. I've built so few bikes. It's the whole thing is a little embarrassing, but I guess the thing is that I enjoy exploring the process. I think that to me the goal is controlling the process. There's so many different steps from design till the bike is going down the road, and certain parts of it seem for me fairly easy to control, and other parts are very difficult to control. And I've just never been motivated to try to build another one and another one and another one. And I don't know. I spend a lot more time thinking about frame building and hanging out with frame builders and talking about frame building than actually building bikes. So I don't know. I think I should say that I know that I don't deserve the accolades that I get.
I'm not so sure I agree.
You just don't know.
I don't know, but I'm looking at your frames. I think part of it is the aesthetic that I like is the aesthetic that evidently you like, because they sort of match up, that lugged classic look of the bicycle and the colors you pick and just the whole thing. They're, you know, the randonneuring or the touring or the curved, you know, the sort of the raked fork with the curve. They're just things about them that are very elegant that appeal to my aesthetic.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome very much. So I want to talk about carving lugs, because you do some amazing lug carving and you show a lug as you get it. I think you're using, whose lugs? Pacenti, maybe?
That's probably what the pictures you're looking at, yeah.
And uncarved and then what they look like carved. What inspires you to come up with the shapes that you come up with? I mean, how do you decide this head lug is going to look like this as opposed to that?
I don't know. I guess what you're probably looking at is a Florida Lee pattern. When Kirk Pacenti came out with his Artisan Lug series, it kind of triggered a renaissance in lug cutting, and particularly in this country. And, I guess I felt challenged to do something interesting with them. And I thought the Florida Lee is kind of an interesting motif. And you've seen lots of different Florida Lee lugs historically. So I just thought I'd take a crack at that, and I made one bike and another bike and another bike and just tried to evolve that shape. And I don't know, it's just kind of fun to try to make it a little nicer or something like that.
How long does it take you to carve a lug?
I've never timed it. It's probably a few hours at least per lug, something like that, but I've never timed it.
Okay. So I want to ask you two questions, then we're going to need to take a break and we'll come back, but what do you think about disc brakes on road bikes? I ask this to everybody, but I'll ask you because I'm expecting a different answer. Let's see what happens.
I'm not qualified really to respond to that. I closed my retail store 10 years ago.
Right.
So I have, minimal exposure to that issue. But I think the thing that all that, in the hand-built world where the randonneuring bikes and stuff like that, where we're thinking about having a fairly high level of compliance, particularly in the fork, where it's kind of you need a very, very stiff fork for disc brake. So it's sort of contradictory there. I don't think anybody can question the performance advantages of the actual brake. The disc brakes, I think, are clearly superior, certainly in wet conditions. But I don't know. I haven't, I've got a mountain bike with disc brakes. They work great, but I don't really have a strong opinion, pro or con, regarding disc brakes on road bikes.
Okay, that's a reasonable answer. I think it answered my question. Before we take a break, I want to ask you, who's doing your painting? Are you painting yourself?
No. I mean, I've done a few rattle can jobs, but it's a whole other discipline that I have yet to embrace. I've used several different painters over the years. My last bike was painted by my pal Peter Weigel, and he painted a few bikes of mine early on too, but he's pretty busy and I usually don't like to bother him. So I've sent quite a few bikes to a guy named Todd Arrows in Pennsylvania who does wonderful work. One of the big issue with finely crafted lugged frames, when we thin the lugs down dramatically, the paint has got to be put on very, very thin. Otherwise, you just lose the detail that you've put so much effort into. So that's one of the things that, I think the traditional frame builders are looking for in their painter, is a painter who can put the paint on thin. So that's a big issue, but Todd does a great job.
We are going to take a real quick break, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit about the basics of bike building, geometry, how it relates to balance and fit, which are important topics. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're speaking with Jamie Swan. We are back on the show. We are speaking with Jamie Swan, as I said before the break, and we left off talking about paint. I'd really like to talk a little bit about basics of bike building, geometry, how it relates to balance and fit. You, on your website, which, by the way, if you have some time, listeners, and you really want an interesting read, Jamie has an amazing history, and he does it by decades, which is kind of interesting. It's jamieswan.net. Anyway, you talk about getting things balanced. There's a video that I watched. I think it's a 6-minute and 20-second video. And yes, you talk a little bit about geometry and balance. How do you decide on geometry? I know you built quite a few of the bikes that you've built for yourself, but for anybody, how do you choose a geometry, head angle, seat angle, bottom bracket height, that kind of thing?
Well, I think the design process is in two parts. One is for purpose and the other part is for fit. So purpose means, are we building a track bike? Are we building a randonneuring bike? Are we building a pizza delivery bike or a tricycle? So, from the purpose standpoint, you have to think about the size of the diameter of the wheels, the width of the wheels, the type of gearing, tire clearance, fender clearance, and the types of, geometry relative to that, the head angle would be different for a mountain bike than a road bike, et cetera. So that's one whole family. And then the other side is fit, and human beings are not evolved to ride bicycles, so we can't adapt our body or contort our body to fit the bicycle. We need to make the bicycle fit us. So we look at the cyclists, their length of their leg, the length of their upper leg, the length of their feet, a whole series of anatomic measurements, and then distill that down into the particular measurements of the bike that make it fit them.
What happens when you have a rider who needs to sit more upright, and do you change the lugs because a level top tube doesn't always work for everybody? How else would you accommodate somebody who's sitting more upright? And a randonneuring bike is kind of a good example of that, because you need to control the bike a little differently from that higher seat to lower bars.
It's an excellent question, Diane.
Oh, thank you.
You're good that way. I think that for a lot of traditional builders, really majority of the customers are not racing and tend to be a little older, and we need the handlebars higher. So to me, you start off by just figuring out exactly how high you want the handlebars to be and how high the seat has to be, and then connect the dots by drawing a frame into that between that seat, pedals, and handlebar. The real question is, how do you do it so that it's aesthetically pleasing? I don't know if you're familiar with a product called a Nitto Technomic stem.
Oh, yes.
So, and probably most of the listeners know what that is. It has a tremendously tall mast on it, so you can get the bars very high. You can make the handlebars higher than the top of a drop-style handlebar. You can get it higher than the top of the seat if you need to. But it looks a little clunky, It looks awkward. So the builder often is trying to come up with a more aesthetically pleasing solution of how to connect those dots. The Pacenti lugs that you mentioned earlier have an extension so that the head tube winds up being taller. So some people like the looks of that. It tends to mask the awkwardness, although it doesn't really raise the bars that much. Most builders are looking to raise them even more. you can, another whole thing is riding a taller frame. So you have less seat post exposed, and that effectively makes the handlebars higher. And that's a look that some people may or may not like. One of the things that I've done to address that issue is to embrace a sloping top tube, even though it's not very traditional. Actually, if you look back through the annals of bike history, it is very traditional, but the what we think of as like the vintage lightweight bikes from the, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, they always had a horizontal top tube. I've kind of drifted away from that as a way of getting the bars higher, and it's very effective. I think people are used to seeing what's called compact geometry, which is in modern road racing bikes, you know, and that happened in the 1990s, where they were essentially dropping the back end of the top tube and exposing more seat post. But what I'm doing is raising the front end of the top tube and making the head tube taller and getting the bars higher.
How do you accommodate the lug, though? Is the lug designed to accept the head tube, top tube change in angles? Is there a change there?
There are some lugs that are designed for a sloping top tube.
Okay.
I think Daryl McCullough, who builds under the name Llewellyn, it might be the first guy who he came out with a lug set that he called Slant 6, and it had a six. It was made to, for a 6-degree sloping top tube, and subsequently there have been other lugs that are made to accommodate a sloping top tube.
Yeah, see, I think that's the right solution, too. So you lengthen your head tube, and you don't have a technomic stem, and you don't have the seat post 16 inches out of the seat tube. I agree. I like a sloping top tube. I don't think aesthetically it's a bad look. I mean, unless you're getting, you know, a 20-degree slope or something ridiculous like that. But
one of the things that, just on that theme, one of the things that I've done that I haven't seen anybody else do, I typically make the handlebar stem also, and I make the extension of the stem at the same angle as the top tube, and I'm convinced that that draws your eye away from it. It fools you into thinking the bike has a horizontal top tube. Are you following what I'm saying there?
I'm sort of stunned thinking, well, duh, what an interesting idea. Sure,
people
I can follow that.
People are used to seeing the horizontal top tube and the horizontal stem, but
right.
If you tip them at the same angle, you won't even see like up to 4 or 5 degrees.
Right.
It doesn't even catch your eye, but like each degree moves the bars up about a centimeter.
Right.
So I built a lot of bikes in that 5 and 6 degree slope, which is not a lot of slope compared to modern road bikes. I mean, a lot of them are like, I don't know, 10 or 12 degrees. So I can't tell you how many times I've been like riding next to somebody or talking to somebody in front of one of my bikes and then making some mention of a sloping top tube, and they'll say, what are you talking about? And I'm riding on a bike with a 6-degree sloping top tube, and they just don't even believe you, which is a little startling to me that they don't see it.
Yeah, well, we know that people's eyes are fooled. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Jamie Swam. We are going to move on to something that is really near and dear to my heart, and that's wheels. And now you are a wheel builder. I believe in hand-built wheels. What do you think about some of these wheel sets that are being offered today? It started out with like Mavic and their paired spoke wheels. I don't remember what they were called. They were red. And it's come up now. Everything's carbon. What do you think?
Again, I'm maybe not so qualified to speak about them because I've been away from that whole end of the scene for a long time. But I'm certainly not a fan of the proliferation of more and more and more cogs that are making the wheels super dished. Seems like the industry trying to answer a question that nobody asked. And I'm also not a fan of carbon fiber rims or carbon fiber in general, I guess. But, you know, I'm not crazy about the failure mode. So, you know, the fibers themselves are incredibly strong and have an infinite lifespan. They have this super high strength-to-weight ratio, but they're held together with glue, and when the glue fails, it tends to do it abruptly. So frames and forks and rims failing that way, I don't see that as a great thing. But I don't know, the straight-pull spokes, like we first saw that with Roval wheels in the early 80s.
Oh, yeah.
They held up real well, you know, so there's certainly a lot of things about modern wheels that are good. you know, I as an old timer, I lament the passing of handcrafted wheels, and that was my vocation for 14 years. That was my full-time job, was building bicycle wheels. So it's kind of a shame. Like, bike shops don't even build wheels anymore.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, right on. Okay.
We still build wheels. So you already answered the carbon fiber question. I got it, and I'm sort of right there with you. What do you think about titanium?
Titanium is great. You know, the fact that you don't have to worry about painting it is very nice. I guess I'm a fan of metal bikes in general, and if titanium is probably my second choice. As a frame builder, it's kind of uninteresting. You can't get the variety of tubes that you can get, like in terms of tapered tubes, butted tubes. I mean, there are some things out there, but it's, I guess I'm pro-titanium, but I'm not really intrigued to start building out of titanium myself.
But you could.
Well, I'm not a TIG welder. So,
oh, okay.
I mean,
I can TIG
weld, but poorly. So there's a steep learning curve there. So, yeah, I guess if I really wanted to, I could. I could build carbon fiber bikes if I wanted to.
That's true. I guess so. I mean, if you really wanted to, you could do all of it. So next year, NABS is going to be in Connecticut. Are you going to go?
Maybe I'll wander up that way. I guess it's near Peter, so we'll probably go over there and harass some of the builders.
That's really a good idea. So I have a completely different topic to talk with you about, and that is your house.
Okay.
It's 200 years old. Is that, did I understand that right?
Yeah, it's something like that. We don't know exactly. It might be a little more. It could be from the 18th century, but it was probably built around 1800.
Holy smokes! So where is this house? What is it that is? I saw the word salt box. What does that mean?
That just describes like the shape of a house.
Oh.
Like you know how a Cape Cod house is like a single gabled design where it has a sloped roof in the front and a sloped roof in the back, but a salt box, that sloped roof in the back is a lot longer. It gets a lot closer to the ground, and it's named after a wooden box that held salt that had that same shape.
Aha. Uh-huh. So what have you done to this house? I mean, have you completely restored it?
Well, I don't know. Restored might be a little generous, but we've just bought it because it was dirt cheap. We bought it. Marion was 25 and I was 26, and we just wanted to buy a house, and this place was just literally falling down. So it was much, much cheaper than any other house that we could find. It had been uninhabited for years, and it was unmortgageable, and we just had to tear it limb from limb. I mean, every possible inch of mechanical systems, you know, plumbing, wiring, water service, gas service, it's all been replaced. All the windows have been replaced. About half of the framing has been replaced, you know, insulation and drywall and blah, blah, blah. It went on for years.
Yes, it's like a boat, a hole into which one pours money, right?
It's true.
Right, right. What do you do for fun? Please don't say just ride your bike.
Yeah, no, I wasn't going to say that. I like fishing. I mess around with gardening. I love to read. I hanging out with frame builders is a big part of my social life. We have
funny how that works.
Yeah, we have a little email list server for frame builders in the greater New York City area, and that's I really enjoy getting together with these guys. We just we talk shop. We get together frequently and for shop sessions where we're going to examine a particular aspect of frame building. And we'll all take turns at doing things, and then we usually get pizza and have a couple of glasses of wine. And so that's, I don't know, part of my social life.
How many frame builders are there in the New York area?
I think the email list has about maybe 80 subscribers, but
wow.
Most of them are guys who have built one or two frames. Like our requirement is you have to have built a bike to go on, to be a subscriber to the list. So, I mean, you have quite a few hobbyists or, you know, people who are just fledgling frame builders. But there's a number of commercial builders in this area working. I guess, you know, Johnny Coast is a good pal of mine and probably the senior statesman of the Brooklyn contingent. And Seth Roscoe is another guy. We've got Lance Mercado, who builds under Square Built. Thomas Callahan builds under Horse. and now I'm going to get myself in trouble because I'm forgetting other guys.
No, that's okay. We'll just say that's just a few of them. How's that?
Okay, that's great.
What's your favorite food?
Oh, I don't know.
Please don't say pizza.
Pizza, cheeseburgers.
An all-American guy, okay.
Something like that.
What kind of music do you like to listen to?
Country music, folk rock, traditional stuff.
Okay. You have any pets?
No pets, sorry.
You don't have to apologize. It's okay. Well, this has just been so much fun. I am glad to have had a chance to talk with you. We do have a mutual acquaintance. Well, actually, he's your friend. He's an acquaintance of mine, Michael Haddad. And the new Italian, vintage Italian exhibit is opening up May 11th in Brooklyn. So I guess maybe you'll go see that, huh?
I'll be there.
Yeah, I'll bet you will. Unfortunately, I probably will not. I would love to be there. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. It was just a pleasure.
The pleasure was all mine.
All right. You have a wonderful day.
Thanks. You too, Diane.
Okay, Jamie. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's our show for this week. I want to thank Jim and Maria Parker for their conversation. It will be interesting to see whether USAT will relent and allow Jim and Maria to enter recumbent into a sanctioned event at some point. You can find out more about Jamie Swan at his website, jamieswan.net. His decade-by-decade history is a fascinating read. We'll be back next week with a brand new show. Oh, and if you haven't done so and you want to get in on the action, remember, the National Bike Challenge is in full swing. This year it's supported by Strava, and you can see what everyone else is up to. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great week. And if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.